Blog Talk Radio.
Too much month left over at the end of the money? Bad credit holding you back? Want to become a real estate investor but haven't won the lottery? Learn how to fix your credit, get out of debt, and build true financial independence with real estate in 1 hour a week. Tune in to Unlock Your Wealth Radio with Heather Wagner. She'll show you how without winning the lottery or working 10 jobs. And here's your host, Heather Wagner.
Greetings and salutations, everyone. Welcome to the broadcast. You are listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio with Heather Wagenhall on this fabulous graduation day for my step-granddaughter, Saturday, Money May 11th. We are broadcasting live from the HQ Real Estate and Investment Offices in Scottsdale, Arizona. And yes, today is the day for many high schoolers here in Arizona to make that ever-popular walk across the stage and grab the first diploma that really means anything and gives you entry to society. And I'm so excited. Unfortunately, I didn't plan better, and I'm not able to be attending the graduation in person. But I am really excited for Alyssa. She is a spectacular student and even more spectacular tennis player, and she has several Ivy League colleges knocking at her door wanting her to attend. So she truly has the world at her feet, and I wish her well and the best of everything. And remember that hard work and everything that she's put into getting where she is only going to continue to pay off. All she has to do is keep her nose to the grindstone. Anyway, welcome, everyone. I am so excited to be bringing you this week's show. This Saturday and every Saturday at 10 a.m., for those of you who are joining us for the first time, we broadcast the Unlock Your Wealth radio show and talk about crisis management and financial wellness tools designed to help you, every man, woman, and child alike, manage their finances and attitudes for the single purpose of financial independence. And this broadcast will not disappoint, as all the others. We have an incredible lineup this week. We have blockbuster national bestsellers. We always have great authors to give us insight and information. And today is no less of a disappointment. We have the most incredible Jerry Robinson going to join us today. And Jerry has written the new bestseller, Bankruptcy of Our Nation. And we're going to talk about the 12 key strategies that he has researched and written about for protecting your finances in these uncertain times. Additionally, our Minutes on Your Money will feature several stories this week. Building Budget-Wise Kids, Top 10 Money Drains from Jerry himself, Letting Immigrants Fix Our Housing Mess, and Will the U.S. Dollar Survive? I know. Ooh, scary. Then we also have Investor's Edge, where we're going to talk about insurance and the appropriateness of insurance and what you need to do, not just to get insured, to make sure that you are appropriately insured, not over or under. Additionally, we have our regular segment with News by the Numbers with Karen Gurm. And nuts and bolts this week, we are going to talk about our featured key, which is Hope for the Best, Plan for the Worst. And we're going to talk about a tiered financial preparedness plan that goes along with this week's key. And as always, we will have our key statement, key affirmation, and key action item for you to get going. Now, if you are not currently a subscriber to the Unlock Your Wealth e-zine, you may want to be, because the e-zine brings you upcoming information about future shows, as well as delivers you the trivia question a week before everybody else gets it on air. Now, the best way to win the trivia question is to A, subscribe to the e-zine, and B, be prepared by listening to last week's show, because all of the e-zines feature a question taken from information that's been shared by or through the e-zine. That'll give you a chance. If you are not able to listen live, you can always download our show to listen later to your iPod or to your computer or any other MP3 player. You're able to listen and still win, even if you couldn't catch the episode live. So that's a pretty fantastic thing. So last week we talked about the credit crisis and why it was a heist, and one of epic proportion, I may add. All you have to do is name one reason why the credit crisis was a heist. So if you listen to last week's broadcast, you probably have a good idea. If you don't, and you would like to be a part of future e-zine trivia questions, all you have to do is subscribe. You can do that one of two ways: by visiting our website at www.unlockyourwealth.com and log in. And on the show page, all you have to do is drop your email address in and sign me up. Press the button, and you too can be a part of the information magazine that belongs to our fabulous show. The second way is just to send a simple email. And all you need to do is send an email to ezine, that's E-Z-I-N-E, at unlockyourwealth.com. ezine at unlockyourwealth.com. Simply put subscribe me in the subject line, and you too can receive all of this great information. Additionally, it's been pretty popular lately when I talk about different things that we feature in Nuts and Bolts and with the Key, that people are requesting worksheets that I've been offering. So if you want to sign up and get today's worksheet that goes with our Key, Hope for the Best, Plan for the Worst, and it's a worksheet that goes along with a tiered preparedness plan. Also, when you subscribe to the e-zine, say, please sign me up for the worksheet. I want the worksheet. So anyway, the e-zine is a fabulous tool for you to follow. And again, for those of you that are interested in participating in the trivia question this week, the question is, name one reason why the credit crisis was a heist. In order to call in to win, you must call this following phone number. It's area code 718-508-9002. 718-508-9002. Additionally, if you're listening live on the internet, you can participate in the chat session that we have. And if you have any questions for myself or for the guest, if time permits, we would be thrilled to feature your question on air. You can call in or you can message it in through our chat board through the radio show. If you are listening through the show page featured on our website, the place to start the chat would be www.blogtalkradio.com with a / and Unlock Your Wealth, all run together. Again, that's www.blogtalkradio.com/ Unlock Your Wealth, and click on the chat session to participate. We will answer the trivia question in the second hour for those of you that think you have what it takes to win. What we are giving away for this week's trivia question is an autographed copy of our featured speaker this week, Jerry Robinson, and the bankruptcy of our nation. It was a fascinating read. I was amazed at all the information that was in it, and so I was pretty excited to read this book and to be able to have an autographed copy for you, our listeners. So if you're the lucky winner, this is your time to get this fabulous book. So moving on, let's talk a bit. Let's start some minutes on your money while we're waiting for our guest to call in. And I found some really interesting articles this week, one by Scott Burns. And I found this fascinating. He writes, "Let immigrants fix the housing mess." And he shares with us, "Perhaps the U.S. should consider a radical change in tactics to eliminate the housing surplus and stop falling home prices, and this time without costing taxpayers a dime. He writes, our friends in Washington continue to reward the witless members of the financial sector. Meanwhile, those of us who don't fly bonus class think about importing guillotines from France. Thankfully, we may not need to place the order. His idea is all we have to do is get Washington to listen to the best idea he's heard to end the decline of the housing prices and thereby restore our confidence in the most important assets most Americans ever own. And that is economist A. Gary Schilling and real estate developer Richard S. Lefrick. The two of them say, don't think about artificially low mortgage interest rates and other stopgaps. Instead, eliminate the oversupply of houses. Too many were built during the speculative bubble, and by the way, make sure that we don't spend a dime of taxpayer money by doing this. How can this be done? Their simple suggestion is open our borders to immigrants who can buy homes in the U.S. Let 1 million immigrants a year do this for 2 years, and the entire oversupply of homes and condos would be absorbed. Supply would no longer dwarf demand, prices would stabilize, and the most important assets of the vast majority of Americans would, once again, be a source of pride and security. I question this. It says, although there has been much attention to the incredible decline of the equity markets around the world, the reality is the vast majority of Americans have far more at risk in the housing market than in any financial assets. Indeed, Americans have more at risk in the used car market than the stock market. And according to the Federal Reserve's 2007 survey of consumer finances, where the PDF of this research is available on the internet, by the way, households at every level of income had more risk in the values of their home than in financial assets. Those in the top 10%, for instance, own primary homes with a median value of $500,000 compared with the median financial assets of any kind. This is like 401ks, cars, IRAs, etc. Quality of life savings, $404,000. Versus $500,000. It says households in the middle of the income distribution owned homes worth a median home price of $150,000 and had only an average of $18,000 in financial assets. So middle-income Americans, in other words, in their estimation, have about eight times as much to lose in the home resale market as in all financial markets. So Schilling estimates the 96 through 2005 boom left in excess of almost 3 million homes, or 2 years' worth of building. Here's my challenge with all of this, and I don't know exactly what they're thinking, but if anybody's ever taken an entry-level economics class from even high school, which was my first foray into economics, and I thank goodness that our high school football coach was the one who taught economics, instead of the scary Miss Cameron that everybody was afraid of, and I certainly wasn't her fan from being blood drive chairman and always having to talk to the high school seniors. I was so lucky to have the teacher that I did. He made economics tangible for us. But one of the things that we learned is it is a symbiotic balance. You only have lose-win or win-lose. It's a zero-sum game, okay? There is no win-win with the economy. When you tweak one thing, it's like a scale, and the other side can potentially be imbalanced if you don't think about this. And while their fabulous idea to absorb the housing inventory, which I don't think that they realize that it is an entry-level housing that's the problem, it's those move-up homes that are the ones that are killing the marketplace that had the overvalues. And I'm speaking to the point here in Arizona specifically because I lived this. I was a native Arizonan. I've watched two housing crises now. This is the second one I get to live in and through, because this too shall pass. But what they don't think about when they make this ridiculous recommendation is, for all of the border states where there's these people are going to come because they don't have enough money to get any further, is how are they going to pay for these homes once they move in? Because if they're here, what are they going to do about the jobs that they had in their former country? And, oh, what happens if they didn't have a job in their former country? Whose job are they going to take now when jobs are so scarce? Okay? And there's one thing that we forget about when we talk about opening the borders. And I can't speculate so much for Canadian immigrants, but I can speculate about Mexican immigrants. Those people work harder than anyone I've ever seen and will do it for less money. So all of the jobs that we're scraping to keep around, given the current economy and all of the rising unemployment we have, how on earth are we going to be able to continue to supply quality jobs when there are people that are going to take the lazy Americans' jobs away from them because they're willing to work twice as hard for half the money? So are we really solving a housing crisis by creating a bigger unemployment crisis? This is something I want y'all to think about as you're sitting there going, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. And in case any of you weren't paying attention this week, I saw a disturbing segment on CNN about all the stuff that's in this amnesty bill, and it's kind of getting a little ridiculous here. So there's no particular party to blame because both parties are working on this amnesty bill, but it just needs to be thrown in the wastebasket, and we need to go back to what this country was founded on and a melting pot of what it is. But we had controls for immigration, and we need to just go back and work those controls and be realistic about how we structure our country. Because we're not trying to fill up our country right now, because now the country is full of people and we are able to propagate our own culture and our own race and nation of people. So since we're able to do that, we actually have to be more vigilant about what's going on in our borders. And I think after you hear from our guest today that you're going to be even more scared about the thought of letting more people into this country when our government can't manage the ones that are here. So I would like to move away from Minutes on Your Money for a little bit so we can talk to today's guest. I am so excited to welcome Jerry Robinson to the broadcast. This man is on a mission to wake up America by challenging believers to think and thinkers to believe. Jerry is an ordained Christian minister and an economic authority and advocate. He brings fresh insights to mankind's age-old problems. As founder and president of Jerry Robinson Ministries International, he creates and distributes biblically informed and culturally aware publications and audio teachings. Since 2001, Jerry Robinson's writings, lectures, and teachings have reached over 95 nations. He is the author of 4 books, including his most recent major release, which is Bankruptcy of Our Nation, and an autographed copy is yours if you happen to answer the trivia question correctly this week. He has a weekly column that's currently published through WorldNet Daily, and in addition to this, he leads weekly teaching sessions in Tulsa, Oklahoma, at the Veritas Theology Forum. He also holds a degree in economics from the University of Tulsa, and I am so thrilled to welcome to the broadcast today Mr. Jerry Robinson. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. It's really my honor to be here. I've been looking you up all here online, and I've just been really, really enjoying what you've been saying. And so, no, the pleasure is mine. Thank you so much.
Oh, yay. Wow. Well, thank you for the lovely compliment. I'm so excited to have you on. You know, I have to share a little story with you that really made all of this possible for me. And I taught real estate at one of the local schools here in Arizona, and At the time, I was a mortgage lender in addition to being a real estate agent. But I had my real estate license in order to be able to teach real estate. I wasn't actively pursuing real estate. And I had this great loan officer training program that I used to do. And it was an all-day Saturday class, and it taught the ins and outs of loan officer training on what you needed to be to become a loan professional here in the state of Arizona. It taught all the requirements, and then not only that, but I taught people selling skills and how to structure their practice. And a woman came up to me after sitting through my program the whole day, and she came up to me and she introduced herself, and she asked me what I would charge to teach that segment about credit, how credit works, to her congregation. And the reason why she sat through my class, she was the pastor. Her name is Pastor Shermaine Fort. And she sat through my class because one of her parishioners is a real estate agent. He wanted to start selling their group. But her flock consisted of primarily single African-American women with children. And clearly they had financial issues because the fathers were absent from their children's lives, both physically in the parental form as well as financially. And so what she wanted to do was hire me to have me go speak. And I was a guest on someone else's radio show, and I had just started working out the kinks with my keys to riches. And I said, I tell you what, I said, I will speak to your flock at no charge if they will fill out worksheets and actively pursue my program. And I said, and they need to give me feedback, what they like, what they don't like, what's working, what's not working. And I was so fortunate, and I'm so grateful to Holy Gospel Word and Worship Center here in Arizona, because as a result of that, being able to work with these women, out of 40 women, and most of them had high school educations, and just two of them had some college. But I was able to take away, you know, out of these 40 women that participated in the program, two of them actually created the opportunity for home ownership for themselves and their children and moved through to a level of financial literacy that was unheard of, and a couple others, while still renters, were at least able to break their dependence, their multi-generational dependence on welfare. And I was so excited about being able to do that, because Pastor Fort showed me so much about the Bible, and I was really actually very impressed that there are over 3,000 financial references, I think, something like that, in the Bible to money, and it almost seems like it's more of a money management tool versus just a collection of stories to teach you how to be a good steward of God.
Oh, certainly. I mean, the number, just so we're accurate, you know, and nobody's keeping score necessarily, but in the book we had mentioned that there's over 2,350 verses, so you're very close, that refer to money. And the reason that I think that God has so much to say about money in His Word is not necessarily because He wants all of us to, you know, to be, you know, fantastically wealthy and have Lamborghinis, and you know, as some maybe have taught, but there's an even more important reason. There's no doubt that God wants us to prosper, but there's another more important reason, I think, that God has put that in His Word, and that is that money is a very deceptive thing. It's something that can really deceive us. It's a deceiver, and the Bible talks about that greatly, about how if you don't have spiritual wealth, then all the physical wealth in the world is not going to do you much good. And so what He tries to do in His Word, and He doesn't really try anything, He always accomplishes whatever He tries. What He does in His Word is He gives us a foundation for understanding a proper view of money. If we strictly only look at the world's view of money, and if we approach it from a CNBC standpoint or from a Money Magazine standpoint, we're going to find hype, we're going to find opinion, we're going to find just the cultural view of money. If you follow the patterns that the world teaches about money, you're going to end up broke. You're not going to have much savings. You're going to be you're not really going to know the rules of the game. You're just going to be out there kind of hoping, and hoping that you're going to end up okay at the end. Bible talks about how men need to save. It talks about how we need to not be in debt to other people. It talks about the importance of diversifying not only your assets, not only your savings, but also your income. It has a lot to say about all these things. And so, and again, the reason that it does is because the Lord knows that we cannot serve both Him and money. And money begs to be worshipped. It begs to be worshipped. And so we have to be in control of our money and not have our money in control of us.
Oh, agreed. And I always tell people, it's a tool. It's not a goal. It's a tool.
Very good.
And
I like that.
When we use it, you know, and people say, you know, all sorts of things, and they say that money is the root of all evil, and it's not. It's just a tool, and it's up to the individual on how they use that tool. They can use it for good or for evil, and it's the individual's choice. And as God gave us all free will, He said, you know, to make your own way. And, you know, some people don't always do good things with it. But, you know, I remember Newsweek had on the cover, God Wants You to Be Rich. And the headline was great. It was snappy, and it really caught people's attention. But, you know, in the sense that the more you have, the more you can do for others is what I really felt like people should have came away with, you know.
Sure.
And with money, if you use it properly and provide for yourselves and for your family, you are able to serve others and to be able to, you know, uplift the people that maybe cannot help themselves for whatever the particular reason regarding to ability, you know. And then to be able to help uplift others and to be able to help them get back on the path if they happen to have strayed from the path.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure.
So I really enjoyed the book. So it's kind
Thank
of
you.
Funny now because whoever wins the trivia question this week is going to get it used because I read it. But it is an autographed book nonetheless, but I did crack some of the pages to read the book, and I really enjoyed it. And I wanted to ask you, what made you write this book?
Well, since about 2003, I have been out sounding the alarm about the faulty foundations of America's economics. I mean, we really do have a lot of internal structural problems inside of our economy. And so I've been talking about it for some time and doing seminars and lectures, and wherever I can speak, I'll speak. And I've been doing that since 2003. And in 2006, about that time, I really sensed that I needed to write this book. And I had self-published books prior to this one. But I felt this one needed to be published and have great distribution because of the imperative nature of the topic. And so in 2006, I began to write this book. And, of course, it was trying to, like, you know, it was like nailing Jell-O to the wall. I mean, things were constantly moving, so you had to keep updating the numbers and everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it took me about 2 years before I could actually find a publisher who was interested in carrying it. And it was ironic. I was in Denver giving a speech, and I got back from the speech back to my hometown, and I had about 8 missed calls on my phone from the airline trip. It's not a very long trip from Denver to Tulsa, so I was concerned. Oh, my gosh, you know, the first thing goes through your head is there's an emergency. And I checked my my voicemail, and it was my literary agent, and he said, we have 5 offers on your book. We need to move this thing quickly. So it was September of 2008 whenever the offers came. And I think the literary world began to realize, oh, you know, there's actually a problem in the American economy, and maybe people actually buy books on it. Unfortunate for them that they didn't have an opportunity to have this out much more sooner. This book probably should have been out 3 or 4 years ago. But it's what it really does is it attempts to show 5 of the most alarming economic trends that confront our nation, and it also prepares the reader in how to deal with that personally. Reforming the government to have them fix these trends that we talk about in the book, whether it be the government entitlement program, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, or whether we talk about the collapsing dollar, whatever the trend might be. We cannot wait on the government to fix this. We have to be empowered financially ourselves, and we have to be prepared for the coming fallout that is going to result from very poor economic, monetary, fiscal policies that Washington has continued to do. So this is all about empowering the individual to help them understand what they need to do right now. These strategies at the end of the book are sound, and they are for right now. They help people understand what they should be doing right now.
I like that about it. Now, as an economics major and everything that you learned in college, while you were researching the book, were you surprised by the numbers? I mean, were they bigger than what you thought?
I never have really internalized the numbers. You know, it's, to me, I've always looked at them in absolute shock. You know, when you realize that America now has an $11 trillion debt, I'm just getting used to millions, you know. Billions, maybe. I mean, trillions, I can't even, my mind cannot even fathom $1 trillion. So we have $11 trillion in a national debt. But that's not all. That's actually just skimming the surface, because that's only the debt that we have now. Next year, and the year after that, and the year after that, it's accumulating at an enormous rate. And by the year 2040, we have a chapter in the book called The 2040 Crisis. And by the year 2040, just from Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid alone, just those programs, those entitlement programs, we have a $60 trillion unfunded obligation to those people we promised money to. So we owe $60 trillion just from those programs, let alone our Defense Department, let alone our Education Department, let alone our space program. I mean, you look at all the things that we're trying to do, and then you look at how our government is progressing forward. We are in a very negative state, and it doesn't matter if the stock market goes up or down. It doesn't matter if, you know, your stock does well this week or not. It has nothing to do with that. We have a long-term structural imbalance that is going to lead to something that is going to be very severe. And what we do in the book is we go back and we historically identify this in the past. So we're not just making this up as we go. We point back at how other empires have risen and they've fallen. And there's no doubt about that our economic empire that we have now is vast. It's great. It rules the world. Our dollar rules the world. But even that now is coming underneath question. And other currencies are being bannered around as a possible replacement. So many people don't fully understand the economic ramifications of all this. And we try to bring that down to their level in this book. And I think one of the things I've heard greatly about the book, and this, I so appreciate these comments, is that people said it was a very loving book, and the fact that it wasn't written over my head, it wasn't trying to impress me, it was really just trying to help me understand what was going on. And that's really what this book was all about. I really wanted to reach out to the average American, whether they be a believer or not, and have them truly understand the problems that we have and what they can do to protect not only themselves, but their children and their grandchildren.
Well, my husband always says, he says, you know what, my grandkids aren't even going to be able to pay this off. And I remember in the 90s when Michael Jordan was the deal, and I don't remember how the number came out or where it came from. And when, you know, people were trying to embrace or wrap their arms around just the money that he was making with all of his endorsements and stuff. And I remember that the number $202 a second is what Michael Jordan was earning. And that was just, you know, in the few millions. Like, I cannot even imagine how much money is being spent by our federal government per second. Like, if you could break it down to that number, then I think people will start getting it. I think the numbers are too big when you talk about billions and trillions. I mean, how do we, like, visualize that or make it real for us? You know,
well,
because it's such an inescapable number.
That's a great analogy. I mean, let's just say, for example, let's break it down to that level. Let's say that one of your listeners right now were, let's say we had the ability, you and I, to give away $1 a second for the next 20 years. To the eighth caller, right?
Okay.
So So whoever calls in, we're going to give them a dollar a second for the next 20 years. That's a pretty nice little reward. I would take that in a heartbeat. And over the course of 20 years, that would equal somewhere around $600 million. That's a really nice payday. Our government spends that on interest to the national debt every 13 hours. $630 million every 13 hours they spend that amount on interest on the national debt. That's wrong. That's immoral. And so it's something that has to be dealt with. We bring some things like that up in the book where when we do lectures and seminars, of course, we show this in visual form, which is always very stunning. You know, our visual presentation of this usually provides a lot of takeaway, you know, for people. They can go home and explain it. And also about the book too, we really view this. You know, when you introduced me in the beginning, you said I'm on a mission to wake up America. No doubt. In fact, I'm speaking at a Wake Up America conference next week in Virginia, and we're really on a mission right now to do this. When somebody buys the book, I always tell them, read it and then give it away. You know, don't let it sit on your shelf. This thing needs to get out. So you're absolutely right. People need to fully understand this for themselves, and it may take $8 gasoline before they get it. It may take $8 milk before they get it. I don't know what it's going to take. I know that people got pretty upset in 2008 when gas prices got high. It may take 60% tax rates before they get it. It may take 18% interest rates before they get it. They will see these things, and people will prepare. Will they prepare beforehand, or will they prepare now? We're asking that they begin to prepare now.
Yeah. Well, and they need to, because this is bigger than ourselves and our immediate family. I mean, this is, you know, if we expect to leave a legacy, you know, and just have our lineage continue, you know, I mean, if our grandkids had grandkids, is this ever going to be paid off? I mean, because we're not doing anything to stop the hemorrhaging. I mean, because I think of this as a big bloodletting. And we're not doing anything different. We stand up, we put these politicians on these pedestals, and we hear them pay us lip service, but at the end of the day, they just kind of get in there, and they enjoy flying on Air Force One, and they go out and glad hand and do public appearances and show up at colleges and give speeches, graduation, and at the end of the day, we're still hemorrhaging $600 million every 13 hours in interest? I mean,
it's stunning. It's unimaginable. And the thing is that people can do two things. They can seek to reform the government, which would require a total, absolute overhaul of the entire government. Or they can just begin to save money and be wise. I mean, we say, you know, obviously reforming the government would be nice, but it's a lot like trying to rearrange the furniture on the Titanic. It might be a lot of a waste of time. It might be better for you, before you begin to get hoop and holler about the government, maybe you should hoop and holler about your own personal finances. Perhaps you should make sure that they're in order. Get those things in order. Spend all of your energy, spend all of your time protecting those you love and protecting yourself. And then once you have that in place, then let's think about what we can do outside of that. Many people follow the news, they follow the government, they see all this that's happening, and they know that they should be doing something, but they're not really doing anything. And so we try to speak to those people and motivate them. And if we have to use shocking numbers, we will. We have plenty to use. I mean, this government it's unbelievable. And so one thing that we say in the book is that in 1980, America was the greatest creditor nation in world history. Never had there been a greater lender nation than America. In 2009, we stand as the greatest debtor nation in world history. Never in history has there been a nation that has had so much debt. No nation has ever survived this type of debt load. But no one has ever had this type of debt. Now, when you talk about this from a biblical perspective, if you ask people what the Bible has to say about debt, they'll quickly say, well, the Bible says that, you know, debt is usually not good. Well, how so? Well, they say, you know, the Bible tells us that a borrower is a slave to the lender.
Exactly.
So the Bible does say that debt is slavery. And so this is kind of a paradigm shift in thinking. but you have to look at it from a biblical definition. If America is the greatest debtor nation in world history, it also makes it the greatest slave nation in world history by biblical definition. And there's no doubt about it. I mean, we're slaves to our jobs. We're slaves to the system. We're slaves to the government. We are literally slaves to this setup that has been created. Some people break free. Some people begin to save. Some people are able to break free and actually have a decent retirement. But you know the numbers, they're very dismal. Most people,
right,
a large majority, retire dependent upon friends, family, and federal government because they fail to plan. And so this is what we're talking about in the book. We're trying to light that fire underneath their feet to be wise stewards of their money. And if it takes seeing the government in absolute shocking detail to do it, we're willing to do that, whatever it takes to have them be responsible.
Oh, well, I totally agree. And I wholeheartedly support your mission because, you know, if we cannot clearly illustrate, and, you know, this starts with good parenting, you know, and I know, and I always say my money management skills that I learned from my mother was, if it was on sale or you had a coupon, you were morally obligated to buy the item, whether or not you ever would use it in your entire lifetime. You had to, like, have it. And she was, you know, a kid from the 30s, so she grew up with that whole depression. And, you know, if anything happens catastrophically, I'm going to my mom's house because my mom has at least a year's worth of canned goods and, you know, a deep freezer full of food that, you know, you could probably put an entire elk and a buffalo.
You know, there was a lot of people laughing at those types several years ago. I don't think they'll be laughing in the near future. I mean, I think, you know, even the Wall Street Journal has got it through their thick skull that they need to, that people need to be, you know, putting a stockpile of food away. Just about last year, I believe, they actually had an article about the fact that people needed to have 6 to 9 months of food stored away. Or maybe it was 6 months. 6 months of food stored away. And that was encouraging. That was encouraging to hear.
Yeah, well, I remember when the new millennium occurred, and so I was very slow and systematic about my acquisition of food, so I was able to create a stockpile. Everybody made fun of me, but I had one bedroom that I had probably a year's worth of tuna and canned chicken and every, you know, possible vegetable that I liked that came in a can. Set aside, and, you know, we always had a surplus of water at the mortgage company I worked for, so every week I would just five-finger another one of those five-gallon water bottles, and I just kept piling them up, and I had, because I had a two-story house, I had panels of that wood sheeting, so I could board up the bottom part, and I could just sit up top with my rifles and shotguns and pick off people if I needed to.
There you go. There you go.
And I was already, and everybody kept making fun of me because they're like, nothing's going to happen. And I'm like, and what if it does? Then you don't get to come knock on my door. Oh, yeah, because it'll be bolted from the inside and you won't get in. So, you know, but you know, we're in tough times. We're in truly complicated times, you know, and I think that
I tell you what something is that they are tough times right now, but you know when you really look at it from a kind of a macro view, you know what you see is that right now actually times, while they're bad in some respects, they're also good. And let's think about this for a minute. This is actually very bad news when you say that it's good news, and this is why. Right now, inflation is relatively low. In fact, there's even threats of deflation from some corners. We also see that gas prices, while they're creeping up now, they're still relatively low. Interest rates are historically low. Tax rates, believe it or not, are historically low levels. They can only go up from here. The fact that foreigners are still choosing to buy our debt, that's good news. So there's a lot of things that we have in place in our systems that are still intact. And everyone knows. I mean, when I go out and do a lecture, I say, how many of you think taxes are going to be lower in 20 years? Well, nobody raises their hands. They know taxes are going higher. Of course, interest rates. You're a mortgage broker. You know that rates can't stay this low. You know, I mean, you know that it's going to have to go higher. So the rates are going to certainly go higher. And, of course, with all the money that's been printed, this inflation trifecta that we have, where the White House is spending money, the Treasury Department is bailing out companies, which requires money, and then you have the Federal Reserve, which is printing money. I mean, you have an inflation trifecta. When you put that much money into the system, there's only one thing that can tame the inflation, and that's a raising of interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we certainly see much, much, much higher interest rates in the future. So while these times are bad, they're actually not as bad as we see them being in the next 5 to 10 years. So now is a great time to begin stocking away. Unemployment is, while it's high, it's not necessarily that high. I mean, we can see it get a lot worse. This is where we say that, you know,
countries totally beat us in that game. We are really lucky in that department, and I know everybody's freaking out, but, you know, our unemployment is not that bad in comparison to other nations.
In relation, yeah. Sure, it's all perspective. And, you know, the other day I held $100 trillion in my hand. I held $100 trillion. And, in fact, I'm trying to get several of these so I can hand them out whenever I speak.
Mm-hmm.
From Zimbabwe.
Oh, yeah, I know.
They now have a $100 trillion note. And it's worth, I think maybe $60 U.S. dollars. But it's $100 trillion. And this is the fruit of very bad economic policy. This is what happens when central bankers begin cranking up the printing presses. And so, you know, you and I, we haven't lived through times like that. We haven't seen Weimar Republic. We haven't seen, you know, some of these things. Yugoslavia had one in 94-95, but America's very insulated. We think in terms of dollars only. If you go to Europe and you're walking down the street, it's very common to maybe convert your euros out of euros maybe into some other currency. If you're in Israel, the same thing. If you're in the Middle East, you can convert currencies. But here in the United States, we think in terms of dollars only. That's very dangerous for us, because it's almost like a fish in a fishbowl. One of the things we talk about in the book is that people who save money, we advocate that everyone have a six-month savings plan, no matter what, 6 months of annual gross income at all times, and that money should not just be in U.S. dollar-denominated assets, but it should also be in foreign currencies and even precious metals. And the reason is because those types of things are not dependent upon the U.S. dollar. So it's a way to diversify your risk with your savings account. And, of course, before anybody does anything, as you know, I mean, they need to talk to their own financial advisor. But that's just simply some of the things that we talk about in the book. It's very vital that we begin to think outside of the box before we get smacked. Zimbabwe, people who live there would have loved to have taken some of their savings and put it into other currencies had they known. And those who were privy to it did. You know, there's a lot of really rich people down there in Zimbabwe now, because they saw what was happening. They moved out of the currency, and now they're living on hog heaven down there because they were able to foresee it. Americans, what we try to do in the book is help them shatter the myths of the mindsets of the American economy that has been just poured into our head. Most people, I think, are not going to see it. I think they're going to continue to listen to the TV news. They're going to continue to listen to the media. They're going to continue to listen to the politicians, and they're going to be sheared like sheep. And it's so unfortunate. But there are some who are going to turn to the Bible. They're going to turn to words of wisdom, and they're going to look for wisdom for this hour. And that's what we feel like we're doing here with this book. We're trying to help people understand what has happened before in history, how we're on the same collision course now with the very same thing. Facts are stubborn things. We're heading right towards the brick wall like every other empire has. Mm-hmm. And what can we do now? What can we learn from history? And what can we do right now to protect ourselves and our family?
One thing that I've observed over the years about people in general, you know, you would never let somebody knock you deliberately off track. But I noticed that so many people can just be nudged in the wrong direction. And how do you think our federal government got so nudged from our original foundation?
Well, basically what happened is in the very beginning of the country, we fled England. The founders, of course, our founding fathers, they came over from England, and they were very fearful of central banking schemes. England had a what they call a fractional reserve banking system, and they used fiat money. The money was backed up by the full faith and credit of England, and that caused all kinds of complications and problems. And so when our founders came over to America, we hear about that it was religious persecution in elementary school when we read about the founders. It really wasn't so much religious persecution, even though that was a part of it. It was also economic persecution. The central banks of the Central Bank of England had really hurt a lot of people. You know, we were fighting over taxes, not over religion in the War of Independence. So, again, it was this economic persecution that we were fighting. And our founders knew that central banks, in fact, Thomas Jefferson has a quote we talk about in the book, a central bank has more power than standing armies. Whoever can control the money supply can control the nation. And so they were very, very fearful of letting a central bank get in control of the nation's money supply. Well, the first Bank of the United States was set up in 1791, and the charter expired. The second Bank of the United States was set up in, I believe it was 1816, and Andrew Jackson slayed the bank, put it out of business, because he saw what it was trying to do to our nation. And he was the only president, I don't know what your question is. I don't want to give away any answers. I don't know what your special trivia question is, but that would be a good one, by the way.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we move forward, though, and nothing happens with central banking until 1913. Then we see a third Bank of the United States. And this time they're privy. They're not calling it a third Bank of the United States. They say, let's call it a Federal Reserve. That sounds pretty authoritative. Federal. But it's not, because it's not federal. It's federal as Federal Express.
Yeah, exactly.
And reserve, it doesn't have any reserves. It just prints money out of thin air. So, but they moved it forward, and they said, we need to have a bank. And this is going to be the government's bank. If you're a bank, you don't want to loan to individuals. Your goal is to loan to governments, because governments always pay. They always pay on time, because they got taxpayers that are always going to be there. So banks love to do business with governments. And the Federal Reserve is a central bank. It is not the government's part of the government. It is a private banking institution that leeches on the government. The Constitution gives the Congress the authority to coin money. But the Congress subverted that when they outsourced that. The Constitution does not give the Congress the ability to outsource the coining of money. But they decided and they interpreted that they could. And so they outsourced not the coining of money, but the printing of money, which was a complete sin, according to George Washington, based on the Coinage Act of 1792. But they allow this Federal Reserve now to begin to print money, and they're willing to pay interest to this private bank. Taxpayers are going to be paying the interest of this private bank for them to print their own money. So now the Federal Reserve is owed over 60% of the debt that we have is owed to the Federal Reserve. It's a private bank. This is exactly what Washington and all the founders warned about, was these private banking schemes. They always seek to get in bed with government, and then they win. And that's where we are now. The Federal Reserve now has the power to print money at will. The government operates underneath the guise that it's borrowing money from the Federal Reserve. It's a complete hoax. We totally expose it in the book, this Federal Reserve fraud. And what's happened is now we're kind of held hostage. Now we owe so much debt. And, of course, what all central banks do is they seek to remove the gold standard. They did that. The Federal Reserve came into existence in 1913. By 1933, Roosevelt had confiscated gold and removed the gold standard. By 1971, they removed the international gold standard. And now we're nearly 40 years into a fiat currency that's backed up by nothing. Our paper dollars are paper. That's all. There's nothing backing them up. There's the full faith and credit of the federal government is all that backs them up. And that doesn't really mean much anymore, because they're not doing anything to keep our money from losing value. If you lay an apple and a dollar on a table and walk away, and 10 years later you come back, you'll find the apple is gone and the dollar is worth less. Money is a commodity. It's not math. And so that's why sometimes financial planning fails, because it imagines money as being math. And money is not math. It's a commodity. It's perishable. And our money is losing value because of very poor economic policies. So the way our system's set up now is that people have to gamble in the stock market just to have a decent retirement. You know, that's not the way things used to be. This is a very new time we're in. This era we're in. People used to be able to put away savings and just be good savers, and they would have enough. Now you put money in the bank, and you're competing with this thing called inflation, which is very unnatural. It's created by central banks. And so now we have to beat inflation by putting money into mutual fund managers' hands and stockbrokers. This is insane. I mean, this is a very immoral, jacked-up system that we're in. So now we have to gamble our money. Hopefully we beat inflation. This is silly. It's a very silly system. And so, of course, what do? You have to learn the rules of the game, and then you have to do whatever you can. So what does Caesar favor? Caesar favors real estate. Caesar favors precious metals. Caesar favors trusts. Caesar favors your own corporation. So you have to find the things that Caesar favors, and then you do those. But then you also got to be very flexible, because the rules of the game can change. He also favors currently 401ks and IRAs. But we all know that at any time he could slap a 40% surcharge tax on those and begin taxing the snot out of distributions, because there's a ton of money in those tax-deferred accounts that could help pay for some of our long-term debt. So it's very important for people to have very balanced plans so they can weather any types of changes in the rules of the game. And we talk, and again, we talk about all this in the book, so I'm really just referring to the book again.
Right. Jerry, we have a caller that would like to ask a question. Would you be up for taking a question?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. We have Vincent on the line, and he wanted to talk about storage and energy. Vincent, welcome to the broadcast. Vincent, are you there? Hello, Vincent. Okay. Is Vincent there? Hello? Okay, it looks like we lost Vincent. So.
Oh, it's too bad.
If Vincent could call back in, that would be great. We'd love to share his comments online and be able to answer your question live. I have another question for you, Jerry. Now, I like a lot of the 12 key strategies you have in Chapter 18.
Yes.
And I'm a big fan of the 15% savings rule that you have. And you talk about how others advocate only 10, but you advocate 15. And I actually advocate 20. With my program with the keys, but if they're doing debt reduction, I let them go down to 15 on the pay yourself first rule. And how did you come up with your 15?
Well, 15% really is just a bare bone minimum. I think 20 is even better. I think that if you can do 20, you should. I think it's a great idea that you have. But the 15 is simply, again, to simply compete with all of the eroding factors on money. You know, as we mentioned before, money is a commodity, so it does have eroding factors. It does lose value based upon inflation. It also, of course, there's taxation upon money. There is, of course, technological advancements. You know, I have an iPhone now, and you never could have told me, you know, 3 or 4 years ago I would have needed something this elaborate as a cell phone. But the thing is, you know, things, technology advances, and now we have many gadgets we didn't know we needed. So many times our savings is simply deferred expenditure. And so, you know, as technology advances, we're going to want more things than we realize we need right now. So, again, that's another reason to save. Also, planned obsolescence. Things fall apart. Your refrigerator is not going to last for 50 years. You're going to have to replace it every now and then. Your washer. So things break down, planned obsolescence. So we say basically that because of all these things that are built in, if you're not saving at least 15% of your income, you're going to fall prey to the creditors that are out there trying to loan you money at you know, bizarrely low interest rates up front. This is what happens to people who, bless their hearts, they get out of high school. They're 18, 19 years old. They walk into their first job, and the yuppie retirement plan is what? It's a house and a 401k, right? Very first two things you're supposed to invest in. Neither one of them have liquidity. neither one of them are going to meet any of the short-term needs that an 18, 19-year-old needs. But by goodness, he's got himself a house and a 401k. And that's such a bizarre thing. The very first thing that 18-year-old needs is a six-month liquidity plan. Why? Well, if he has a house and needs furniture, well, guess where he's going to get the money for that? From the furniture store.
Exactly.
Credit. So we really got to meet these short-term needs. We got to get in the habit of saving 15%, and then we need to save a minimum of 50% of our income and keep that in savings at all times. People who are savers also, by the way, Heather, they're a lot better investors. If you have, let's say you make $60,000 a year and you have $30,000 in the bank as savings, and the stock market drops dramatically. Well, if you have a pinch, you don't need to go liquidate those stocks. You can afford to go through the business cycle. But people who many times now, as we've seen, conventional financial planning has said stuff all your money in tax-deferred plans, and very little they've done very little to talk about actually saving money. And so many people, you've probably seen the same thing as I am. I'm seeing a lot of people here who are tapping their 401ks simply for liquidity. At the worst possible time. Plus, you're taking a 10% hit, because they haven't been taught to save money.
It's totally insane. And this week's key is actually hope for the best, plan for the worst. And
sure.
In our nuts and bolts section in the next hour, we talk about our tiered preparedness plan is what I have. And I teach people to think like a business, that your planned obsolescence is right. That's why that's why we create sinking funds. We run our personal lives through the Keys to Riches plan like somebody else's business, so we're not emotionally attached to the money. And that's the way I set up and structure this. And we have multiple savings vehicles to accomplish different things in our program, and that's because you need to have an emergency fund for catastrophic events that stop income for some reason. Maybe it's an illness or an accident or the death of an income-producing spouse. And
sure.
You need to be able to weather the storms. And even if you get hurt on the job, so many people think, I got workman's comp. Well, it takes 12 weeks before you get your first workman's comp check. What are you going to do?
That's right.
What are you going to do for 3 months?
Well, a lot of people are finding that out now with unemployment. Many people are finding out they were just one paycheck away from a foreclosure.
Yeah, and when people buy homes, there are some people that, based on their income or how they manage their finances, they're permanent tenants because they don't get or are prepared for the responsibility of home ownership, because you have to paint the exterior of your home every 3 to 5 years, depending on where you live and what the weather conditions are. You have to fix the toilet that doesn't flush. You have to mow the lawn and maintain the pool and fix things when they break. And so many people just don't get that, because for the money that they spent on housing every month, all that was covered, and they called and the landlord sent somebody out to fix it. And now all of a sudden they're responsible for that, and they're not able to meet that obligation, or they just don't. And then when they go into foreclosure, one of the biggest issues that lenders have had isn't that people won't buy these homes. There's plenty of people willing to buy them, but because the amount of waste that occurred on the property during the time that person lived there that they foreclosed on, these renovators and these remodelers are having to spend so much more money because of that. And that's why everybody's taking a killing, because nobody was prepared for this. And when FHA, they made me so mad. They used to discount the upfront mortgage insurance premium if you took a 2-day home buyer's class. And in that home buyer's class, it taught you everything, because I worked with one of the nonprofits that was approved to teach this stuff. I was in a HECTE certified counselor myself. And when they eliminated that and then they just reduced the upfront mortgage insurance premium across the board because times were so good and their accounts were so flush because foreclosures were down, they precipitated part of this. I mean, they were part of this big deal. And, you know, on my radio show 5 years ago, I said, when someone called and said, how long do you think that this real estate's going to keep going up? When's the bubble going to pop? And I told people then, that's not the bubble you have to watch for. And I created my Keys to Riches program as an alternative to the subprime lending world. And I'm like, spend 3 to 6 months tweaking your credit, creating a savings or reducing debt. Let me show you how to become a homeowner. And let me show you how to then turn homeownership into real estate investment and let other people build your financial independence. And I saw this coming with all of those fixed/adjustable rate mortgages that were going out there, and then all of the falsification of documents. And I said, it'll be larger and more devastating than any value issue that our country will have ever seen. And everybody just said, pshaw, that is so dumb. And,
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what I dealt with. I mean, it's these mindsets that have been so ingrained in us. And but, you know, a little bit of common sense. I mean, you're able to kind of look forward and kind of see, you know, one of the things that we also see is with the real estate side, as you well know, I mean, there's going to be a lot more fallout. It's not nearly over. Of course, you have a lot of the, I think 60 Minutes had a pretty good story on it, but you know, you have the Alt-A loans, you have the option arms that are going to continue out throughout 2011, which is just going to be very devastating to many borrowers. And, you know, it's such a shock to the system to see so many things breaking down. And I think people, we live in a microwave generation, so they're very much wanting to see things get fixed now. You know, they want to snap their fingers and say it's going to be okay. Okay, well, they just keep looking at the Dow Jones every day, and every time it's green, they feel better. Every time it's red, they're not feeling good. Look, we have long-term structural problems. People have got to begin to make plans. They've got to begin to do something. They can't wait for the government to fix this. They've got to get on the ball now. And I think what you're doing is fantastic. It jives right in with what we're doing. You know, our missions seem to be very much the same.
Yes, we're on parallel tracks. Now, I know I've kept you longer than I initially asked, but I have one more question for you. And it's a question that I get all the time with regard to my Keys to Riches program. And it's a baker's dozen of financial concepts that teach people how to think like they're wealthy and be in control of their own money. Because I think, and one of the things that I noticed when I first became overwhelmed, growing up super poor, and then I had a great six-figure year job when I was 23, and I had this perception of what rich people did with their money, but it was completely not what they did with their money. I was totally just flying by the seat of my pants trying to guess. And so one of the things that I get asked is, you know, with these 13 keys that I have, you know, people say, well, if you just had to pick one, which one would be most important? And you have 12 great strategies. Out of all of those 12, which one is the most important for you, and why is that?
Well, that's really tough to say. That's a really tough one because I think they're so highly integrated, as you would probably agree. But I think the most important thing is making sure that your plan is flexible. And what I mean by that, I'll need to elaborate on that for just a moment. What I mean by that is that, and let's use Bernie Madoff as an example. You know, he made a lot of people mad, lost a lot of people their life savings, the fellow who ran the Ponzi scheme with the growth securities.
Mm-hmm.
Many people did not have a holistic approach to their investments. They viewed Bernie Madoff as their growth manager. I believe that there's really three sections of anybody's financial plan. There's protection, there's savings, and there's growth. These people viewed the people who had invested with Madoff, they viewed him as their growth manager. That was not very highly diversified. So they basically had a whole lot invested with this guy, and they lost their life savings.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very vital that we not be overbalanced in anything. There's a lot of people on the radio right now or TV who are hawking gold. You know, they're talking about you got to pour all your money
in gold.
Or you have people the same way with real estate. And I'm not, of course, I think real estate's an excellent thing, but it's the same thing if you just pour all your money here. Or there's people who are talking about the stock market if you just pour all your money here. And the thing is that what we got to realize is that there is no silver bullet. There is simply no silver bullet.
Yeah,
that, I think
there's
got to
be a balanced approach.
There's got to be a balanced approach. And I think that's probably the one thing, because people who always feel like, you know, people who don't have savings, they've always got to hit a home run. And so they'll always look for the silver bullet. And so I think the one takeaway thing, the thing that I think that would really revolutionize their minds and prepare them to go forward, is to finally realize that there is no silver bullet. It's going to take a coordination and integration of different products and of different strategies that is going to be combined. It's going to create a beautiful plan that won't break down over time. But there's no silver bullet. I think if they just begin with that realization, they'll be a lot safer, because many people who are going to get burned over the next several years are going to be those who think there's a silver bullet out of this, and there's not. There's not going to be one thing. There's not, you know, it's going to be a coordination of products or a coordination of strategies, but there's not one single strategy that'll work for every single person.
Agreed. I always liken money and dieting, the way people manage it. And so everybody's always looking for that magic diet pill, and I know that it doesn't exist. I'll share with you my single most important key, and for me, because everything else is pretty integrated, and most of my keys are somewhat dependent upon each other. But my last key, my 13th key, is the one that I feel is the most important, and that is to become a voracious reader. And one of the things that I think is so fabulous is your book, because of what Bankruptcy of Our Nation brings to the forefront of people's attention. It's different than other books that I've seen out there like this. And whether or not, you know, you're a believer, whether or not you want to peruse Christian-minded material, the research and the facts and everything else is so important. It's startling, and it needs to be read. And, you know, I know sometimes people get turned off if, you know, your political views or your religious views aren't just quite like mine, but that's not a reason to discount a literary work. And I believe that you should always have multiple points of view and multiple exposure to different information and to be able to form your own educated opinion. And I wholeheartedly recommend your book, and I am so grateful that you took time out of your Saturday to be with us here on the Unlock Your Wealth radio broadcast, Jerry. Thanks again, and thank you for the autographed book for the trivia question, too. I know everybody's going to enjoy trying to compete for that today.
Oh, absolutely my pleasure. It really was an honor for me to be here, and so thank you so much for the time.
Again, great. Thank you, and you have a wonderful weekend.
You do the same. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. So, folks, we have more coming up on Unlock Your Wealth Radio after this.
The best things in life are free. And give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. Your love gives me such a thrill. But your love won't pay my bills. I want money.
Welcome back to the broadcast. You are listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I'm your hostess, Heather Wagenhall. This Saturday, Money May 16th, we are broadcasting live from the HQ Real Estate and Investment Offices here in Scottsdale, Arizona. I am ditching my step-granddaughter's graduation to be here with you folks. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, welcome to the broadcast. We just had author, speaker, and economist Jerry Robinson on with his new book, Bankruptcy of Our Nation, and teaching you the 12 key strategies for protecting your finances in these uncertain times. I mentioned in the last hour, if you were joining us now, that to participate and win his autographed book that he sent for our lovely listening audience, you only have to answer the trivia question. And today's trivia question is referencing last week's broadcast. Name one reason why the credit crisis was a heist. How can you get the trivia question before the show? Very simply, go to our website and subscribe to the weekly e-zine. In addition to all news and information about the upcoming broadcast, you also receive the trivia question, so you can research and be prepared with the answer to win fabulous prizes. In addition to Jerry's autographed book, we will also have 13 weeks of the coaching, the Unlock Your Wealth coaching program, too, to go along with Jerry's book. And it's 13 weeks of financial counseling helping you get on the road to financial independence as well. Again, simply, all you have to do is go to our website to subscribe to the e-zine, which is www.unlockyourwealth.com, and drop your email address into the subscription bar, or you can simply send us an email direct and say, sign me up, and drop an email to e-zine, that's E-Z-I-N-E, at unlockyourwealth.com. Now, if you can't listen live, the great thing about this broadcast is you can go back and download it later. If you have an MP3 player or iPod, you can download it directly to that and listen to the program at your convenience and still be able to win the trivia question. So again, name one reason why the credit crisis was a heist. If you want to call in to win or try to win, our telephone number is area code 718-508-9002. 718-508-9002. And if you want to call in to win, that's the number. Moving forward with today's broadcast, I would like to go on to our regularly featured segment, News by the Numbers. And News by the Numbers is hosted by the ever-popular effervescent and always informational Karen Germ. Karen, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you, Heather.
I understand and how fortuitous that we had our guest prophesizing diversification. I understand that the rally might be over.
Mm-hmm. I think that's correct, Heather.
Tell me more.
I will. This week on News by the Numbers, stocks may falter next week as the blue chips decline of 63 points breaks a six-week run of strong Fridays, and the Nasdaq's nine-week win streak ends as well. Falling bank and energy stocks lead the market lower. General Motors sends termination letters to 1,100 dealers. According to Charlie Blaine and Elizabeth Strott at MSN Money, a big test for the stock market on Friday was whether the major indexes could finish higher on the day, as they had for the past six Fridays. The market failed the test, and now there are worries that the rally that erupted in March has stalled. A higher finish on Friday would have signaled continued investor confidence in the market and in an economic recovery taking hold sooner rather than later. The Dow Jones fell 63 points to 8,269. The S&P 500 index was off 10 to 883, and the Nasdaq Composite Index was off 9 points, or 0.5%, to 1,680. The Nasdaq 100 index, which tracks the largest Nasdaq stocks, closed down 5 points, or 0.33%, to 1,355. The market decline meant that the Nasdaq Composite didn't see a 10th week of gains. The Nasdaq ended this week with nearly 3.5% decline, its first weekly drop since the week of March 6th, just before the big market rally erupted. The Dow fell 3.6% for the week, with the S&P 500 off 5%. Their losses would be only their second since the week of March 2nd. Bank stocks moved lower after FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair told Bloomberg Television that the government may force out some underperforming management. And that is your News by the Numbers for the week. I'm Karen Gurm.
Well, thank you so much for that, Karen. And I understand that you won't be with us next week, but we will catch you before the end of the month. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Well, we will miss you, and I will do my best to fill in your fabulous shoes. And I'll make every effort to try to bring your segment the same character and excitement that you always bring. And
thank you, Heather.
I'm sure our audience will want to have you back quickly after I do that.
I will be back by the 30th, I promise.
Great. Well, you have a great weekend, Karen. Thank you so much for participating in the broadcast. As always, we like to take a market snapshot, and Karen is the one to bring that to us. I have some unfortunate news for you all. Our Investor's Edge feature, which was going to be all about insurance and Brenda Wicks of State Farm, because I ran so far over with our first guest, Jerry Robinson, we're going to have to push her to a later broadcast so we can stay on time with today's two-hour show. Whoever thought 2 hours wouldn't be enough, but it looks like we're heading to that point, too, now. So, unfortunately, we're not going to talk about insurance except for in our Hope for the Best, Plan for the Worst, Nuts and Bolts segment, but we're going to get specific tips and techniques from Brenda on a later broadcast. Going back to our minutes on your money, I want to talk about Jerry Robinson's Top 10 Money Drains. If you haven't decided or purchased the book online through the show page at Amazon.com, let me tease you with some information from the book and see if I can't get you to acquire a copy for yourselves, even if you don't happen to win the trivia question. Top 10 Money Drains. You're going to flip your cookies when you see these. Number one, coffee. According to the National Coffee Association, the average price for a brewed cup of coffee is $1.38. And that's not the foo-foo kind that I happen to like. There are roughly 260 weekdays per year, so buying one coffee every weekday morning costs almost $360 a year. That's so funny, too, because we just had our Minutes on Your Money on Twitter, and we did a coffee one, I think, this week. For those of you who aren't currently following the show on Twitter and getting your Money May money tips every day, well, let's see if I can say that fast five times, please follow the show so you can get your money tips on a daily basis. All you have to do, if you have a Twitter account, is just simply follow Unlock YR Wealth, Unlock YR Wealth, and you too can receive our Minutes on Your Money every single day. So number two on the top 10 money drains is cigarettes. The Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids reports that an average price for a pack of cigarettes in the U.S. is $4.54. If you smoke a pack a day, you're spending almost $1,700 a year for that habit. Alcohol is also high, but assuming an average of $5 per beer, including a tip, and you buy two beers a day, that's $3,600 on an annual basis. That's no chump change for that thirst-quenching adult beverage. Now, here's one, not of the adult variety, that'll also make you flip your cookies. Bottled water. Again, if you buy it from a convenience store for just 20 ounces, it's about a dollar. And that doesn't include if you go to the ballpark where they charge you $5 or the amusement park where it's more than. But just a simple one bottle of water a day, which doesn't meet your 8-glass requirement either, $365 a year. And it also costs our employ- and it, our, tongue twister. It also costs our environment much more from the impact. Manicures. Ooh, no, don't pick on us girls. The Day Spa Magazine price survey of 04 says the average cost of a manicure is $20.50. That'll set you back over $1,000 a year. Car washes, too. Average cost for basic auto detailing package is $58. Doing that every other month is $350. $10 a day for weekday lunches will cost you almost $2,400 a year. This is the one that, fortunately, we don't have these here in our office, but vending machine snacks. If you spend $1 a day while you're working every afternoon for cookies and candies and crud that's ruining your waistline, $260. So while your waistline gets wider, your wallet gets lighter. Interest charges on credit card bills. Here is a devastating amount. In 07, so this is 2 years ago, May, the median amount of credit card debt carried by Americans was $6,600. You average about 13.5% on those cards, and if you just make the minimum monthly payment, it'll take 21 years to pay off the debt and cost you about almost $5,000 in interest. And last but not least, and boy, when I was a lender, I used to see excuses why this was always on somebody's credit in the negative as a collection account. Unused gym memberships. CostHelper.com tells us that monthly service fees at gyms that go unused between $35 and $40 a month can run you almost $500 a year to not lose weight and get healthy. Why waste the money? Be honest with yourself. You don't like running on a treadmill in the same place every day. So if that's the case, get outside, get some fresh air, and get yourself an extra $40 a month back in your pocket. We have coming up next our Nuts and Bolts segment right after this. You're listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I'm Heather Wagenhals.
Hi, I'm Tony Stewart, driver of the number 14 Office Depot Old Spice Chevrolet, and you're listening to Heather Wagenhals on Unlock Your Wealth Radio.
If I were a rich man, diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle-dum, all day long I'd busy, busy long. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. Diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle-dum. If I were a busy, busy rich.
Welcome back to the broadcast. You're listening to Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I'm your hostess, Heather Wagenhals, on this fabulous Saturday, Money May 16th, also graduation day for my step-granddaughter, Alyssa Wagenhals. Hopefully she is a prodigy, a student of the keys, and she will take these with her and create the most incredible financial future for herself and her future family. So are you a referral partner of the Unlock Your Wealth radio show? Would you like to promote yourself on our show? Learn about the benefits that our featured advisors receive by being part of an exclusive program where the listeners are seeking financial independence and are in need of your insurance, finance, real estate, and investment services. To learn more and receive a media kit, please call toll-free 1-866-966-9420. That's 1-866-966-9420. So we're moving to our next segment of Nuts and Bolts, and this is all about our key for this week, hope for the best, plan for the worst. And in this key, what we are going to learn is what our structure has to be. So many people tell you, you need to save, you need to invest, you need to have a retirement account, you need this, you need that. But does anybody ever tell you how to get there? If you go to a financial planner, they're going to say, well, you need a minimum of this in order to invest with us. I can't advise you. Or they take all of your financial information and then they run it through their computers and do this whiz-bang thing with all their formulas and projections and whatnot. And then they kind of tell you, okay, this is what you need to do. And they give you just a dollar amount, and then they want to do it for you for a small fee. But they never explain what it is that you're doing or why you're doing it. And hope for the best, plan for the worst coincides with next week's key, which is break the budget. And for those of you that have been with us since the beginning of this season, you have been saving receipts and getting ready to analyze where you are so you can determine where you need to go from here. Well, this week, I'm going to lay out the tiered preparedness plan that you need to format your break the budget key for next week off of. Now, for those of you who are just joining us today, and are not familiar with our broadcast and would like to be a subscriber to the e-zine and are interested in a pre-printed tiered preparedness plan for yourself so you can use it when you work your break the budget key, all you have to do is shoot me an email and subscribe to the e-zine. By subscribing to the e-zine, you can receive this week's worksheet for the tiered preparedness plan. You can do that one of two ways. One, you can visit the website, www.unlockyourwealth.com, and enter your email address in the subscriber location and click the button to subscribe to the e-zine. Or you can send an email to us directly at ezine@unlockyourwealth.com. That's E-Z-I-N-E at unlockyourwealth.com. And in the subject line, say, send me the preparedness plan. Send me the preparedness plan. That's all you got to do. For those of you who are already subscribers to the e-zine, please drop me a note saying that you're interested in this document if you already belong to the magazine, so I know to get it to you. And for the rest of you, you can take notes. I'll map this out as best I can verbally so you can make a detailed plan. The point of hope for the best, plan for the worst, it takes what we've done with our goal-setting key, Dreams with Deadlines, and while we're being optimistic and we want to accomplish these great financial goals and we're just starting out, anything can happen. The only thing guaranteed about life is there are no guarantees. I've always said when people say, well, what about this or what about that? And I say, well, you know, I have to do it because I never know when I'm going to step off the curb wrong and that Mack truck is going to snuff me out. So I have to have a plan B. And for those of you that didn't even think about, oh, I thought I was just working on my plan A with Dreams with Deadlines. I didn't even know that I had to make a plan B. You must have a plan B because the thing is, we're just starting out. So unless you're holding a winning lottery ticket to a multi-million dollar jackpot, chances are you have a rate of failure or a likelihood of failure because of lack of preparedness. And I always say have a plan B because you never know what catastrophic event may beset you or your family. There's just no way to know. None. And so as a result of the future, which is unknown, and especially with Jerry's foreboding of what will happen, we must be prepared for the worst. There's no point in having a plan A without a plan B. You've got to have a contingency plan because if you don't and a catastrophic event does beset you, then you're not going to be able to continue executing on plan A. It just won't happen. And I don't want your financial future to be dashed because you weren't prepared. And it's very simple. People make mountains out of molehills and don't understand how to do this. But it's a simple tiered preparedness plan that you must implement. You never know what's going to happen. And like I was sharing with Jerry in the previous hour, people think they have a safety net, but in reality, it's not. People think, well, you know, I work for a company. I have a union. I have, you know, disability. I have unemployment. But so many people don't understand because they never read the fine print in those books with the six size font on the very thinly Bible paper type folded sheets that they come in, where you can see the print from the other side, and it's totally confusing to try to read it. And as I get older, I know that I can't read that stuff as easy either, so it's just easier to throw it in the file. But because we don't understand how these programs work, our intent for a plan B really isn't. Because even if you get hurt on the job, so many people don't realize the application and funding process for workman's compensation takes 12 weeks before you receive your first check. And with the average American now less than two paychecks away from homelessness, we used to be 2.5 paychecks away, but now that number's dwindling. We're less than two paychecks away from homelessness. We really need to have an emergency fund set aside. So many people are not cognizant of what an emergency fund means. That's not for the next beer run when the fridge gets empty around the Super Bowl time or the next big playoff game. An emergency fund needs to be 6 months' worth of your income because it must be able to replace income lost due to a catastrophic event. And when I say catastrophic event, I'm talking injured on the job, injured off the job, or death of an income-producing spouse. There's got to be a way that we can replace that income. We won't have credit card balances high enough to cover half of our income because as we learned from our Create Credit Key in the last season, creditors will only give us 10% of our annual income in unsecured debt. So 10% is not 50%. So even if you had all the credit cards you could possibly have and not owe a nickel on any of them, they still won't be your emergency fund. So you've got to get out of the mindset that I can just live off my credit cards, because in today's day and age where credit card companies are reducing balances when people aren't using them because they're trying to mitigate risk, for these types of events, when you haven't had a balance for 8 months and then all of a sudden the card is maxed out, you're not going to be able to use that as a plan B. That is not an effective plan B. So you have to take it upon yourself to create 6 months' worth of emergency fund. And it has to be in a liquid account. Your 401k or IRA does not count as an emergency fund. It can be simply a money market checking account or a savings account that beats the rate of inflation, because right now, mattress money is losing money every day. So with inflation in the fours, you've got to find an account that's going to keep that money. If you put in $10 today, you're going to need to make sure that you have $10 in 6 months, not $10 minus 4% because of inflation. So you need to find an investment vehicle that is liquid enough that if you need to write a check, if your transmission goes out and you need $2,000, or if you lose your job or you get hurt on the job and or get sick and are not able to work, you've got to be able to replace that income. The second type of fund that we start filling as we have filled our six-month emergency fund is a sinking fund. And this is for long-term, you know, preventative maintenance and repairs to our home or other assets like our cars. So when those break down, we have money to fix them instead of running to our credit cards. It's so important to have a sinking fund. If you were a property manager and you were managing a rental property, you would need a sinking fund for those things. So part of your rent that you collect would be set aside for that. So part of our personal paychecks must be set aside for sinking funds when the washer breaks, when the transmission falls out of the car, when we get two flat tires because we drove over something the wrong way. Whatever our issue is, we need to make sure that we have that. Additionally, we need to know what our insurance deductibles are. because that needs to be a part of our emergency, or I'm sorry, our sinking fund for preventative maintenance too, because we want to make sure that we actually have the money if we're beset with having to make a claim. If you have a homeowner's insurance policy and your home is broken into or destroyed by some sort of catastrophic event, and the only thing hanging you up is paying your $1,000 deductible, but you don't have $1,000 to pay, that could be a little bit of a problem for you. So that money also goes into your sinking fund. And because those types of expenses don't occur as often, those expenses, that money can be set aside in certificates of deposit because they become available every 3 to 6 months. That way you know you're outpacing inflation. You're not making a killing, but you're outpacing inflation. The third investment vehicle that you need to have in your tiered preparedness plan is your retirement accounts. If you have an employer that offers 401ks and hasn't taken it away, as some of the big companies are, and has a matching program, you are a fool for not taking that. That's leaving free money on the table. Whatever they have as a matching, if it's 50 cents on the dollar for the first $100, that's $50. If you saw a $50 bill on the floor as you're walking through the mall, would you leave it there or would you pick it up? Of course you would pick it up. Pick up the $50 that your employer is leaving on the floor and have him help you build your 401k. Our 401k isn't the only investment vehicle we have for ourselves for retirement. Your own personal IRA that you can put after-tax dollars in or pre-tax dollars in. Uncle Sam gives you a bonus if you put money away in an IRA in the form of a tax break, and it's more than $4,000 now you can set aside in a retirement vehicle annually. Additionally, if you want to use after-tax dollars, you can stuff a Roth IRA with money. Stuffing, stuffing, stuffing is what we want to be doing. And this is a controversial subject for many, and I kind of like my brother's philosophy on it, although a lot of people won't agree because of the way they were brought up. But the last, not the first, but the last tier, if you choose the tier, and I say if because you may agree with my next philosophy that I share with you, is, and this is only after we have our 6 months emergency fund and we have all the deductibles collected for our insurance policies and a sinking fund for deferred maintenance, preventative maintenance, and we have already established retirement accounts outside of our employment and we're maxing out our 401ks if we have those. The last thing I will allow you to think about is a college plan for your kids. My brother and I grew up dirt poor. My brother and I wanted to go to college. Clearly, there was not a trust fund for us to do that. There was not a college fund set aside for us to subsidize our college expenses. My brother, the lucky duck that he was able to earn an academic scholarship and then took grants and participated in the GI Bill so he could fund his college education. And as a result, he's had a wonderful career in the military almost 20 years now. It's pretty amazing that he has had as a result of his education. And when I asked him what he was doing, he said that he's not doing a college fund. And he said, if my son wants to go to college and he wants to go bad enough, he'll work hard and get a scholarship like I did. And I think that is a fabulous idea. Because my brother was on academic scholarship, he had to maintain a very high grade point average, which meant also that he was getting into less trouble outside of class. But he applied himself to become extremely successful. And if an individual wants to go to college and better themselves, they will work hard and earn scholarships as well, or they'll take on student loans and provide for their own education. I can't tell you how many of my friends that their parents paid for college, and half of them flunked out because they didn't care and they weren't financially invested, either with their own money by borrowing loans, paying for it up front in cash like I had to do because I couldn't get loans, or putting sweat equity into it and having to work alongside of attending school and working their way up. You know, they flunked out because they just weren't invested in their education. And they tell you, you know, I had a great time in college, but I look back and I really didn't get a lot of value out of it because I was too busy screwing around. So the tiered preparedness plan. So let me reiterate it for those of you who are trying to make sure that they have it right, in addition to my oratory after I enumerated each one. You have five legs to this plan. Well, four minimum, five optional. 6 months emergency fund, first and foremost. As we have built that emergency fund and it is in place for emergencies, we will then proceed to build our preventative maintenance fund, which includes, as a sinking fund always does, any annual, biannual, every 5 years, any maintenance costs that we're going to have to maintain any of our assets, and the total amount of deductibles that we have for insurances in the event that we need to make a claim on our insurance plan. Additionally, we will then proceed to fill our own retirement accounts outside of our 401k that we have through work. And then if we choose to do so, because many people are the same mindset that I want my children to have more than I did and they plan on paying for college, the last thing you put in place is college. The first thing is you. And a lot of people think that that's warped, but I've got to tell you, the airlines do not drop the oxygen masks and tell you to put yours on first for no reason. You must be able and prepared to take care of yourself first before you can take care of others. That's why they have you put your oxygen mask on first before you assist anyone else with theirs. The same principle applies here. You must take care of yourself first before you can commit and take care of others. So get your emergency fund in place. Begin your sinking fund for preventative maintenance. Then we're going to start a retirement program outside our 401k. And then and only then, once we have funded those things and reduced our own debt or eliminated it, college for the kids. So that's it. In a nutshell, for the nuts and bolts segment, how apropos. But that's our tiered preparedness plan. Again, if you would like to have that plan written out because you're not a good note taker or you're busy walking around doing things around the house or mowing the lawn while you're listening to the broadcast because it is a Saturday morning, slipping slowly into the afternoon as we proceed with the broadcast, then please just drop us an email at ezine@unlockyourwealth.com. Either way, if you're a subscriber, just say, I want the plan. And if you're not a subscriber but would like to be, we'll automatically add you. Just let us know that you would also like the worksheet for the plan. Now, today's key in Hope for the Best, Plan for the Worst, is an integral part of our success at financial independence. In a way, it's our own personal insurance policy for success, knowing that we'll be able to implement and successfully achieve our plan A, our dreams with deadlines. And I just love how this key works and complements that, because so many people get it backwards. And I don't know about you, but Hope for the Best, Plan for the Worst has helped me tremendously in my financial life because I was the kid that was flying by the seat of the pants, and I said, B, what is plan B? I don't have a plan B. What do I need a plan B for? I'm young, I'm healthy, I'm this, I'm that. And then I was in a car accident where I had my pelvis injured, and that took months of rehab. So I don't know about you, but Murphy is a personal family member, the guy that wrote Murphy's Law. He is part of my extended family, unfortunately. So not being prepared, and that's where I kind of came up with adding to the preventative maintenance program in that sinking fund, also have your insurance premiums, your deductibles in there, because I didn't. And it cost me so much more because of the way medical billing occurs. And for more news on that, either download our Create Credit broadcast from last season or make sure that you tune in June, because we have an incredible summer lined up for all of you folks. But anyway, in June, we'll go through the Create Credit key again, and you'll know exactly what I mean by saying that with regard to medical billing, because it's handled differently than other types of billing and credit that you have. So hope for the best, plan for the worst is a vital part of our entire KEYS program. In order to be able to execute and achieve the goals that we've set, we have to have what-if scenarios. So in this key, this is our opportunity to say, what if this happens? What if that happens? How can I be prepared in the event of a catastrophe? Now, one of the great things about the way this tiered preparedness plan works is that it's a system, and as we go through next week's key, Break the Budget, we may find out that we are actually further ahead on this plan than what we thought based on the way it is tiered, okay? And it's tiered for a reason. And we do it in concert with our debt elimination program and our restructuring that we learn in our Break the Budget key. So that's why this is so important. And it's not that it's just important to have a plan B, but because it's tiered and it's structured and systematic, it makes it simple for you to be able to implement it. You can integrate it immediately into your life, and it's not that painful. A lot of people associate changing and planning with pain, and it's a P that doesn't go. It doesn't belong. And preparedness is so important that we focus on knowing what to do while we're on our path to independence, what to do if or when this happens. And you need to think about how it applies to you personally, because in my life, it's different than what you have in your life. I have stepchildren, and I have stepchildren, and I have stepgrandchildren, but their natural parents have provided for them. But I have my own maternal obligation, and as our parents get older, we need to have a plan B for them. What do we do if then we become responsible for our parents? So this isn't just about you or your children, but do you have an aging parent, and would you possibly be the child that's responsible for this parent? Or maybe you have another relative that's aging that you might have to be financially responsible for down the road? How do we prepare for this? How do we plan? Well, we start our tiered preparedness plan. And as you remember, in knowledge is power, not knowing is powerful, as we assessed what we knew and what we didn't know, one of the things that you need to pay attention to is what type of insurance you have and what levels of insurance you have, and is it enough? Do we have the right coverage to begin with? Is this coverage appropriate for me? Or are we underinsured, which is can be just as bad as not having insurance, because then we're going to be financially responsible for a portion of that coverage. Here's another thing to consider do you have a family history of long-term illness? Do you have a family history of health conditions as you age that may pass on to you? If you know about this now, you can create a health insurance coverage policy for long-term care. This is vital because we don't usually think about this when we think about Plan B. But long-term care coverage, if you know you have it in your family, it's likely to happen to you. You need to be prepared for that because the single most important thing that can wipe out your financial legs in a millisecond is not being prepared for long-term illness. So you have to be able to replace that income and pay for those types of bills that your regular health insurance may not cover on a long-term basis. Your coverage may be capped at a particular number. This happened to a family member of mine who was on dialysis. They had home dialysis for 2 years, and in 2 years, they spent $2 million for home care. It's an astronomical number. For somebody that never had a household income over $24,000 a year, this family member of mine spent $2 million in 2 years and then was ineligible for the home care. And without a long-term care policy in place to continue to subsidize that cost, this family member then had to take and go to a clinic and sit there for hours where dialysis was performed and where it was subsidized by Medicare. So these are the things that you have to think about. These are things that people never think about. And for your tiered preparedness plan, it also comes with a list of questions for things that you need to be thinking about, like just that question. Do I have family medical history that requires long-term care? Could I possibly be responsible for a particular member of my family that right now, today, doesn't fit in my financial plan, but I may have to figure out how to work it in? These things are so important, and so many people don't think about these things. So that's why hope for the best, plan for the worst is one of the most important keys we have in the integral fitting and making all of these keys work. So this week's key statement is, while I remain optimistic about my financial future, I am keenly aware that a catastrophic event may occur to me or my family that could materially alter my financial picture. So I must be prepared for the unknown. I must be prepared for the unknown. This week's key affirmation is, I am prepared for any situation financially that life may throw at me. Again, for those of you that are tracking your affirmations, I am prepared for any financial situation that life may throw at me. For those of you joining us for the first time, we do affirmations every week. We work on both sides of the coin, the external part of our finances, but we also work on the internal part of our finances, which is our attitudes and perceptions toward money. And we work on our affirmations by creating this in our mind that we are able and willing and realizing the affirmation. We say it every night before we go to bed. We read our list of affirmations off. We go through them one by one. And that sets our brain thinking subconsciously all night long about how we can achieve that. And then it's the first thing we see in the morning to start our day off on the right note. And anytime we experience negativity that may take us off our path, we use our affirmations again. This week's key affirmation item is to set up the tiered system and evaluate where you are on it. You might already be doing the right things and what you do have to do if you're not. So that's this week's key action item. I'm so grateful for you joining us for today's broadcast. I'm also thankful that Jerry Robinson, author of Bankruptcy of Our Nation, shed some light on what's going on, please pick up his book through Amazon.com. Next week, it's Break the Budget, and we have diet, longevity, and hormone expert, Dr. Gino Tutera. What does that have to do with budgeting? Well, you'll just have to tune in to find out. My name is Heather Wagenhals. You can follow me on Twitter at Heather Wags. Follow the show at Unlock Your Wealth, Unlock YR Wealth, for your money tips for Money May. And additionally, I'd like to thank you for joining our broadcast and participating in the Keys to Riches. The Keys is a baker's dozen of financial concepts that not only teach you how to think like the rich and be in control of your own money. Join us next week for more Keys.
I've had it up to here, listening to a small segment of people trying to put down America. America's the greatest land on earth, and we ought to be proud of what we have. I'm proud of America. I'm proud of our people, and I'm going to prove it. We're American and damn proud of it.
Frankly, I'm getting a little ticked off.
Go to hell.